Part 1. Chapter 1. The View Out and the View In. 1. The Missing Head. This book is an unconventional attempt to discover, for myself and in my own way, what I am and what I amount to in the universe. What am I? That is the question. Let me try to answer it as honestly and simply as I can, forgetting the ready-made answers. Common sense tells me that I am a man very similar to other men, adding that I am 5'10", 40-ish, grey-headed, around 11 stone, and so on, and that I know just what it is like here and now to be me, writing on this sheet of paper. So far, surely, nothing can have gone wrong. But has my common sense really described what it is like to be me? Others cannot help me here. Only I am in a position to say what I am. At once, I make a startling discovery. Common sense could not be more wrong to suppose that I resemble other men. I have no head. Here are my hands, arms, parts of my trunk and shoulders, and mounted, so to say, on these shoulders, not a head, but these words, and this paper, and this desk, the wall of the room, the window, the grey sky beyond. My head has gone, and in its place is a world. And all my life long, I had imagined myself to be built according to the ordinary human and animal plan. Where other creatures carry small, rounded body terminals, fairly constant in shape and furnished with such things as eyes and hair and mouth, there is, for me, a boundless and infinitely varied universe. It looks as if I alone have a body which fades out, so that almost the only hints which remain of it above my shoulders are two transparent shadows thrown across everything. I may call them no shadows, if I please, but they are not in the least like noses. And certainly, I do not find myself living inside an 8-inch ball and peering out through its portholes. I am not shut up in the gloomy interior of any object, and least of all in a small, tightly packed sphere, somehow managing to live my life there in its interstices. I am at large in the world. I can discover no watcher here, and over there something watched, no peephole out into the world, no window pane, no frontier. I do not detect a universe. It lies wide open to me. These ink marks are now forming on this sheet of paper. They are present. At this moment, there is nothing else but this blue and white pattern, and not even a screen here, where I imagined I had a head, upon which the pattern is projected. My head, eyes, brain, all the instruments that I thought were here at the centre, are a fiction. It is incredible that I ever believed in them. No doubt something is going on here, but whatever they are, and wherever they are, these aches and chafings and roughnesses, these tastes and smells and warmths, are not grey-haired and equipped with eyes and ears. They are not pink and 8 inches across and ugly or handsome. In short, they are not a head. 2. The Head Found. A further and no less remarkable discovery follows. While I have no head where I thought I had one, I have innumerable heads where I thought I had none. Heads mysteriously shrunken and variable, twisted back to front, and multiplied endlessly in every reflecting surface. That my head pervades the region round about is shown first by the fact that I have only to give any object there a polish to find my head in it. Second, by the fact that if I take a box with a small hole in it, that is a camera, and point it to the centre of the region, I find my head trapped in the box. And third, by the fact that my friends tell me that my head is present to them where they are, so that they can describe it in detail. It seems, then, that I am a decapitated body watched from the middle distance by its severed head, now made elastic, turned round to face its trunk, and hiding everywhere. Even the face with which my friend confronts me turns out to be a mask for mine. He cannot take off this mask, but he can tell me what it hides. And if he should be mistaken, at least his camera will hardly repeat the mistake. Unlike him, it cannot be credited with the power of grasping what is going on elsewhere. It is honest about that part of me which it contains where it is. And if it could describe me as I really am, here at the centre, it would be a failure as a camera, for its photographs of me would show me beheaded, with itself, the camera, mounted on my shoulders. In fact, there is precisely such a device, called the first-person camera, which is sometimes used to make a film in which the audience sees, not the chief actor, but what he sees, namely his world, including his hands and feet, and perhaps his pipe and the rims of his spectacles, but never his head. The body with which the cinema audience identifies itself is headless. The effect can be a startling realism, though few cinema-goers are aware of its source. In the film studio, either a headless dummy is used, with the camera where the head should be, or the camera is mounted close to the living subject's head so that it looks with him instead of at him. The many legends of loose and flying heads and of headless monsters are not far from the sober truth, after all. Perhaps also the medieval fondness for martyrs who walked, even if they did not, like King Charles in the ill-punctuated sentence, talk, after their heads had been cut off, owed something to the half-conscious realization that we are all in much the same state. 3. The human region and its center. There is, then, a zone where I keep my heads. Approaching observers report that, towards the inner edge of this zone, my head grows till only a part of it is registered, and that this part gets hazier and hazier till nothing appears at all. Receding observers, on the other hand, say that towards the outer edge of the zone, my head shrinks till it is replaced by the whole body, and this in turn shrinks till it vanishes altogether. Thus, my observers come to plot the boundaries of what may be called my human region. My friend, entering this region, takes on my man's body, and I take on his, for each of us is centered in the human region of the other. The shell of my manifestations has for kernel the shell of his manifestations, and vice versa. Each of us is Brunhilde, perfectly guarded by fiery rings, a magician who casts a spell over all who dare approach, transforming them utterly. But we are not content to exchange heads. Neither of us holds on to what is presented to him, but instead projects it upon the other. Thus, my friend insists that the head he registers is not where he is, but here at the centre of my human region. And he says this regardless of the fact that if he were to come here to verify his statement, he would, like Ixion embracing Hera, find on the way things very different from my head, and then nothing. Or if he came all the way here, he would be in a position to find not what he calls my head, but what he calls his own. To push home, your inquiry into my existence is to destroy it, for I am always elsewhere, like a rainbow or a mirage. If I take myself as I am to myself, I find presented these men, trees, clouds, stars. And I scatter them all as if in a giant centrifuge, leaving the center empty. If, instead, I take myself as I am to others, I am a host of creatures of numberless shapes and sizes, and all of them, though they belong out there, I pull in here as if by a powerful magnet, leaving none at large. Accordingly, it is impossible to pin me down either to my centre here or to the centres of my regional observers there. I am something like a game of hide and seek, in which hider and seeker never meet because each takes refuge in the other. Everybody is out on a visit, but because no one will stay at home to be visited, there are no meetings. We all keep our distance by changing places and live inside out. And one of the reasons why we can never meet is that we more than meet. We become one another. For I do not live here at this center only, content to enjoy what is presented here and to refer it to centers over there in my regions. Equally, I live out there in those centers, contemplating myself as manifested in them. Indeed, I have already found that I am more at home out there observing my head than here observing my headlessness. The view in comes at least as naturally to me as the view out. Unlike Burns, the gift I need is to see myself as I see myself. 4. The view out from the center. Let me now examine in more detail this miscellany of objects which I find presented here. They arrange themselves in many ways, but notably according to their range or remoteness. Thus, all the men I register are dispatched to my human region not many feet away, all the clouds to a greater distance, all the stars still further. I see them there, from here. If my friend is to show himself to me as a man, he must keep off. If he comes too near, he is likely to be revealed as a mass of very lowly animals, and nearer still, he may take on the guise of mere particles. It is as if I carried about with me a worldwide nest of concentric sieves so graded that all things from stars to atoms are caught in its meshes, and thus made to keep their proper distances no matter where I go. Always the chief class distinctions I note amongst my present guests are linked with residential distinctions. If you are a star, you can never trespass out of my star region into any other. If a man, your home cannot be far away. I allow neither slumming nor social climbing in my zoned suburbs. My guests, then, refuse to stay, and I am not content to see them off, making sure that their baggage is properly labelled. I see them home, so that in one sense my boundaries come to include all their destinations to the furthest visible nebula. And when I get there, I turn round to share their view of me. 5. The view in to the centre. Common sense suggests that this self-portrait is strange only because in beginning with the view out, I am beginning at the wrong end, beginning with what is arbitrary and irrelevant and forever changing. One moment I entertain galaxies, the next a dust grain, whereas the view in is constant, of practical importance, and the true revelation of what I am. Does my tailor care whether I am contemplating an elephant or a mouse, or my hatter need to ask whether I am an astronomer or a philatelist? But common sense is wrong. The view in is just as odd and as variable as the view out. To show that this is so, let me call in a really efficient observer. His first rule is to keep on the move and take no one aspect of me as final. Thus, the innumerable views he gets of me in this room, back and front and side, above and below, near and far, are all of them parts of my true portrait. But he sees no reason why he should confine his travels to this room of arbitrary dimensions, and he retires beyond it. Now his story is of a mannequin, a house, a street of houses, a town, a country, a planet, a star. A star that has developed into, or rather absorbed, a solar system, a galaxy, and in the end, a spark of light that goes out altogether. And if, finding this odd, he decides to approach me instead of retiring, his tale is equally curious, and its end is the same. Whether he moves away or draws near, he finds all manner of non-human transformations regionally set out, and finally nothing. Even outside the looking glass world, there comes a point when to get to the Red Queen, the observer must leave her, and to escape her, he must imitate the ingenious cockroach that took refuge from the tortoise by hiding in its shell. The only way to get out of my presence is to make for its center, the one spot where it does not exist. 6. A common sense objection answered. To the objection that it is not I who am so transformed, it may be replied, what I am is the question at issue and may not be prejudged. In any case, if one view of me, say the back view at 12 inches range, is not enough for the observer in my human region, if he must move about there to find out what I am, then there seems no good reason for restricting his movements to that one region, provided he keeps the center of all the regions in view. Again, if I, from my side, tell him that I am occupied with the inhabitants of many regions, and am indeed on visiting terms with them all, then it would be fastidious of him to ban them, ignoring their perspectives of me. Moreover, if it is admitted that the near view of organs and cells, of molecules and lesser particles, is germane to my nature, and in some sense a view of me, despite the fact that it discloses something less than a man, then there is nothing to show why the far view, where the scene becomes more comprehensive, but no more strange, should not be equally valid. At this stage, anyhow, neither can be given preference and neither ignored. For it is not as if there were some reality at the center against which its regional appearances could be checked. 7. The view out and the view in brought together. Both my own view out and my observer's view in are so unexpected that, if either had to stand by itself, it might well be taken for an illusion. But they agree, each supporting and complementing the other. Looking in at me and out with me come to much the same thing, with this vital difference that whereas the first reveals my head, my human body, my planet, my star, my galaxy, the second reveals other heads, other bodies, other planets, and the rest. Thus, the two accounts agree in describing me in human and planetary and sidereal and galactic terms and differ only as to which men, planets, and so on are in question. The view in is of a particular one of these at each stage. The view out is of the others. And their combination, the twofold story which must now be told, is of a pair of mutual observers who, whether they go or come, keep equal rank. When one of them finds himself in the other's star region, he too is shown to be a star. When each inhabits the other's middle region, they are likely to prove men. Venturing closer, they are less than men. Always their relationship is symmetrical. All my looking, then, is looking in a mirror, in a glass which has the knack of showing me not what I call this face, but its rough likeness. And it is often far from human. For most purposes, my arm is too short, and my hand mirror is too small. I cannot hold it in my remoter regions to see what I am there. But all I really need is that perfectly telescopic and elastic glass, namely simple sight, to tell me in terms of others what I am. 8. The elastic self. Now, these remarkable metamorphoses are not tricks of perspective, but really are happening to me all the while. Consider the place I call here. When I tell my dog to come here, I mean to this part of the room. When my friend comes here, he comes to this house. When foreigners come here, they come to this country. If one day Martians arrive, they will arrive here, even though they alight in Australia. The rule is that my here grows and shrinks along with my there. Again, I find myself taking up the viewpoint of such diverse units as my solitary human self, my family, town, country, and even planet. And this unit that I think for, that I vaguely feel behind me, that I have for backing, is on a par with what I am facing or up against. When a man offends, this man is offended. When a nation offends, this nation, no less, is up in arms. Once more, equality. I grow at a moment's notice a body to match what I have in mind, though it is true I can discover this body only by taking up my station in other bodies, in my regional observers, who are where I keep all my property. My region's boundaries are the tide marks left by my outflowing and ebbing sympathy. In fact, there is nothing here at the centre but a receptacle for others, an infinitely elastic receptacle for infinitely elastic objects. And this centre is half the time swelling to include in its own non-entity the surrounding regions with their full population of observers, and half the time shrinking to extrude them again, like myriads of rabbits out of a master magician's top hat. Thus, to perceive another man is to centralise and abolish all of this man, atoms, molecules, cells, head, and total body, in his favour. Thus, to perceive another planet is not merely to look beyond all of this one, nor merely to incorporate it, but also to dissolve the whole of its mass into empty room, so to speak, for that planet. When mutual observers approach, thereby shrinking in each other's estimation, each produces the other from his own central void. And when they recede again, thereby growing in each other's estimation, each does so by reabsorbing the other. 9. Both views involve centre shifting. An important complication is that my observer is obliged, from time to time, to alter slightly the direction of his gaze. He attends, say, to a cell, and then as the cell shrinks and vanishes and a limb comes into view, his line of sight is likely to move a little. It moves again when the whole man takes the limb's place, and later there occur shifts of direction from the planet's centre to the solar systems, and from this to the galaxies. And once more, the inside story confirms and completes the outside. My observer sees truly when he finds the lesser me eccentric to the greater. For when I forget my private interest and identify my well-being with that of my town or country or planet, I find myself acknowledging a more distant centre and placing myself there. The larger the unit to which I am thus attached, the more remote its headquarters are likely to be. Initially eccentric, I can grow only by correcting this condition, stage by stage. My observer finds this out in his own fashion, I in mine. 10. Illusions of grandeur? Here, then, are the makings of a new portrait of myself. It is not what I had reckoned for, but it is drawn from the life. But is it, perhaps, too flattering? Am I not in danger of thinking too highly of myself? The danger may be averted by four considerations. First, that my base, which I can never cut loose from, is my merely human phase. Second, that if I am more than human, I am also much less. Third, that it is only by sinking myself in my object that I rise to its status. Fourth, that in myself I am nothing but a reception centre for others. My life is the life they live in me. Take away these visitors of mine, and I vanish. Alter the least of them, and I am altered. The fluctuation of a variable star is a fluctuation in me. I am different because of the cloud that is now sailing past my window, for it is not white, or swift, or beautiful over there, but here, from there. Unless they leave home and arrive in me, or in some such home from home, my objects, from my friend's face to a spiral nebula, can never amount to anything. truly I forget in what my wealth and true grandeur lie, and how inexhaustible they are, and how my title to them is my absolute poverty. Plunging headfirst into the sea of nothingness, I find there untold treasure. 11. The depth of the picture. This abundance, this wonderful universe of objects, is present to me and not absent, presented and not represented here. And indeed, the slightest attention to these things discloses that they are two-dimensional, that they have breadth and height, but no depth which really succeeds in coming between us. For the radii that connect me with them, though I may make a show of reckoning them in inches or miles or light-years, are only so many points when taken end-on. Between two planets in the sky is a palpable gap, but between them and this planet is no such interval. Yet because my objects are essentially centrifugal, there arises between us that mysterious third dimension, which is in fact not a dimension at all, till it is changed into one of the others. It is, as pure depth, non-dimensional, a quality of otherness, including perhaps majesty or holiness or transcendent constancy, rather than a quantity of remoteness. And this quality of otherness or thereness is itself realized here at the center, along with the rest of my object's qualities. The truth is that if I find the main conclusions of this chapter incredible, it is because, full of preconceived notions, I lack the simplicity to notice what is always staring me in the face. 12. Relativity and the regional schema. This center is the spaceless bud, which is never and yet always bursting into the immense flower of my many-regioned space. Now, this exfoliated space is essentially hierarchical. And hierarchy is the natural development of relativity, of the principle that an event or thing is the system of its manifestations to observers elsewhere. Taking this principle seriously and applying it to myself, I find that I saturate a graded space, in fact, space-time, a nest of boxes whose value varies with their size, a cosmic onion instead of a cosmic potato. Hierarchy is quantitative reality turned qualitative, disembodied and uniform, and human observers become embodied and multiform and non-human, in different space mapped out into something like the ancient circles of heaven and earth and hell, with all their traffic, naked and invisible light richly clothed in every garment of its hierarchical wardrobe, the light which falls off as the square of its distance transformed into the light which evolves men and universes as it advances. And already the outline of this regional constitution of mine is hinted at by the physical science which distinguishes between the Euclidean geometry of my middle regions and the non-Euclidean geometry of my nearest and furthest regions.